Andrew Solomon is a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University. He's president of Pan American Center and a regular contributor to The New Yorker, NPR, and The New York Times Museum. He's the author of the new book, Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. Far and Away encompasses South Africa and Brazil, China and Romania, Guatemala and the Solomon Islands, as Solomon explores the unfolding of history, largely through the people who are creating and being shaped by it. Andrew Solomon will be speaking at Oblong Books at 6 o'clock Saturday, the 7th of May in Rhinebeck, New York, and it is a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Andrew Solomon, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a complete pleasure. Thank you.
What brought you to want to collect these essays and really look at these shifts, both political and cultural?
I had been doing various forms of international reporting over a very long period of time, and I began to think that these pieces, which had appeared individually, actually added up to something when taken all together. I was struck by how a new rhetoric seemed to be creeping into the conversation that was anti-immigrant and that was in some sense anti-travel and anti-international, that was about closing down our borders, closing ourselves in, that was being presented as some kind of safety. And I wanted to write a book about the world, a book that said, throw open the doors, throw open the windows, look at all of what's out there.
And this is something, obviously, that you have been doing for 25 years, as the subtitle suggests. At what point have you realized the importance of that, of going to these continents and going to these places and seeing what is indeed going on and chronicling those changes?
I started just wanting to see the world because I was curious about it, and also because I somehow felt that I would be safer if I had friends everywhere and knew everyone. And then bit by bit, as I kept working on the book, I was struck that I wound up repeatedly in societies that were in moments of great hope. There were societies where change appeared to be happening. Now, in some instances, that change actually did happen and the hopes came true. And in some instances, the hope didn't happen and the dreams didn't come through. Nonetheless, the experience of hope, that repeated experience over and over again of seeing people frothed up into optimism, was very moving to me. And I began to seek out places where change was happening and to try to look at what change really felt like to the people on the ground.
I do want to talk about those changes in the individual places where you traveled, but let's talk about travel itself for a moment, because that really is the theme of the book, of the importance of travel and bearing witness. And how do you maximize the experience of traveling and being able to see what is happening in these seismic shifts that are occurring?
Well, I think I have gone to places. My finding in general is that the best form of reporting is reciprocal. So the old cliche is you just go and look at something and write about it and try not to disturb it. In the first place, I don't think you can observe something without disturbing it. And in the second place, I don't think that you get very deep into people's minds if you're just standing outside and watching them. I think you have to participate. You have to engage with them in their lives. You have to do things with them and live with them and open yourself up to their ideas. You have to answer their questions if you want them fully to answer yours.
You do say in the book that living in another country is entirely different from traveling through it, but there are benefits to both.
There certainly are. I lived for many years in England. I sort of lived for a while in Moscow. Most of the other places in the book I visited, some many times over a period of many years, some just very briefly on one particular short visit. I feel as though the distinction that became most crucial to me is the one between tourism, which involves looking out at what is alien and remarking on how alien it is, and travel, which involves engaging with what is alien and coming to find it less alien than you thought you would.
And do you like to be both at some points?
Well, I think everyone is always both. I mean, even if you are just the most sort of obvious tourist, at some level, you have to notice a little bit of what's different about the place you're visiting from the place you come from. And even if you think you're the most inveterate and serious traveler, you're always a little bit of an outsider in other societies. Some of us feel like outsiders even in our own. And you always are busy being surprised by things, surprised by the beauty of monuments, surprised by the strangeness of what you're eating, surprised by all of the other things you wouldn't have anticipated. The thing to do, I think, is to understand the two ideas and to find a balance between them. And the balance that comes to seem right for you might be different from the one that seems right for me or for any of the many people who will be listening to this program. It's a personal economy that has to be calculated.
You mentioned the time in Moscow, and the beginning of the book, the two dispatches at the beginning of the book are from the USSR. What did you get from that experience, especially so early in your career?
I had always wanted to see what was then Leningrad. And I was writing the arts column for a British magazine. I'm American, but I had gone to graduate school in England, and I had stayed on for a while and was working there. And Sotheby's was having a big sale of contemporary art in Moscow. And I was interested, really, in the fact that when I looked through the catalog, I thought the art was pretty bad, and all of these people were being flown out on this big fancy tour. And I thought, oh, they're all going to buy this undistinguished art just as part of the hype that Sotheby's has brought to the whole thing. And then I got to Moscow and I began to meet the artists. And I met them and I thought, oh, I see. The work was deliberately made to look banal in order to avoid the unwelcome attentions of the KGB. But it's actually full of encoded meanings. And the key to understanding those meanings is knowing the artists, because these artists had never been allowed to show their work publicly and had always shown it only to one another. And once I understood that, then I realized that it's often the case that when you go from your own society into another one, things you think you understand are things that you don't understand at all. And for the artists, the making of art in that late Soviet period had felt like a high moral purpose. As one of them said, you see, we were in training to be not artists, but angels. Mm. And then suddenly along came the Western market. And the Western market didn't ask them to be angels. It only asked them to be artists. It was a big adjustment. Mm.
Andrew Solomon is our guest. The new book, Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. The book encompasses South Africa and Brazil, Romania and China, Guatemala, the Solomon Islands. But so much of this book is about the people. And I'm curious as to how you, the obvious question of how you find them and to get that person and the group of people who open themselves to you and you open yourself to them.
Well, I'd begin by saying that there is a frequent error of sorts in journalism in that many journalists go and they are interviewing either government officials and wealthy business people who are usually quite programmed and have a significant agenda in what they communicate, or they quote from the taxi driver, the waiter at their hotel, the person who cut their hair. The voice of that larger group of people is, of course, incredibly important. But most societies also have a world of people who are engaged with the issues confronting their society. They're artists, they're journalists, perhaps they're doctors. They're operating at a different level from the government officials and a different level from the so-called common man who's being interviewed. And I feel like that segment tends to get neglected. And I really have gone into these societies and made friends with people who I imagine are the people I would have made friends with if I had lived over a long time there. Now, I say made friends. Some people I've kept in touch with for decades. Some, there was a feeling of intimacy, and then I left, and that was the end of our contact. But it's a long process, and it involves really engaging with people and then having the people with whom you've engaged say, oh, if you're interested in that, let me introduce you to my friend over here who, and on you go. And I found that the networks build up very, very quickly as long as you're willing to be as open with the people you're interviewing as you've asked them to be with you.
Do you often provide a service to them in some way of being, for want of a better term, that outsider, of someone who is visiting as a traveler or a tourist? And because you see the changes that are developing, you see what you can compare what was there when you first went, or even if it's the first time, to how you imagined it, that it gives a perspective that those individuals perhaps do not see right in front of them?
There are really two pieces to the answer to that question. One is that I'm very open to giving people solid, practical advice. You know, you're an artist in South Africa and you want to figure out how you get a gallery in New York. I can't give you any guarantees, but I can give you some information about how the process usually works. So I'm very open with that kind of information, or indeed with information about what day-to-day life is like in my country. Then at a deeper level, I think people very much want to be heard. And a lot of the people I've written about are writers or artists, not all of them, but many of them. And they want to have their self-expression validated. And if you go and you really listen to what they have to say and ask them questions about it, they're often much more deeply helped by that than you would think. I mean, it's the interview as a sort of psychoanalytic session in which you say, you know, well, what else do you think about that? And, huh, and why did you do that? And so on and so forth. It's helpful to people to articulate those things, and in many instances, helpful for them afterwards to see how they all got written down.
And how much are you looking for adventure, and how much are you just trying to be safe?
Well, I try not to take idiotic risks. And, you know, I'm not rushing off right now to the sort of battle lines with ISIS. But I also wouldn't want to have my ability to tell stories and to engage with the world constrained by fearfulness and anxiety. So I'm kind of a fearful and anxious person at some level, but I just decided a long time ago that I was going to try to go for it and to engage with people. And weirdly, in places like Afghanistan and Libya, where people thought I was going to be in a lot of danger, I felt reasonably safe. And sometimes in places that seemed much more sedate, I've encountered a surprising wave of violence. I think the only time that I've been personally physically attacked was when I was in Taiwan covering an exhibition loan from the National Palace Museum. So it was hardly what sounded like a high adventure trip. But I felt that I wanted to know the world. I felt there was so much noise around the strangeness of other places. And I wanted the experience of what was beautiful and exotic. There's certainly that adventuring element in it. But more than that, I found in those first trips to Russia that elements of myself got sort of broken down by being stripped out of context of my own, and that elements of my perception got sharpened by seeing completely new things. And I wanted both those processes to last across a lifetime, and I think they have.
You mentioned Taiwan. You were punched in the jaw in Taiwan. You were kidnapped in Ecuador. For how long?
Just for an afternoon. I had been traveling many, many years ago, and I had gone to see the ruins at Ingapirca with my brother. We had gotten a guide to take us. We had heard that there had been a little bit of unrest in the area. We weren't much worried about it. On the way back, we were driving along a road when we came to a gigantic boulder that was in the middle of the road. And just as we were trying to figure out what it was doing there, people jumped out from the side of the road and began attacking the car. They smashed the windows. They drove nails into the tires. The guide said we'd better get out. And we got out and we were all taken over to a hut, which we were locked into, while the driver tried to negotiate our way out of it. And we were there for the whole of the afternoon. It turned out that this particular community was in revolt because they didn't like paying taxes. And I told them that I wasn't so crazy about paying taxes myself, though I think they accomplish certain crucial things. Anyway, we had a certain amount of back and forth, and finally, at the end of the afternoon, they relented, and we then had a long, long walk until we got to a road where we could hitchhike back to town.
You mentioned a moment ago about ISIS, and I'm curious as to how much of you wants to go there and just knows it's not the right move, and how much of you says, well, there's so much more of the world to see.
I would very much like to be spending time in the Middle East because I feel it is at the center of what's happening in the world. And if we want to know what will be next and what it will look like, it's an important place to be. I'd also like to be there because I am convinced, having had the experiences I did in Afghanistan and Libya and Kazakhstan and Turkey and other parts of the Islamic world, that these are not places that consist only of warlike peasants and corrupt bureaucrats. They're places where there are human beings leading very human lives. And if I were able to tell those stories in a lucid fashion, it might perhaps soften some of the angry outrage that leads people to say, we just need to carpet bomb them, we just need to kill everyone there, all of this angry rhetoric that's surfaced now. So I think there's a lot to be done. Now, having said all of that, I now have children. I didn't at the time I was starting to work on this. And the idea of putting my own life in immediate danger and being separated from them for a long period of time is not as attractive to me as it would once have been.
When you look back on the book and compiling the essays, does it give you a perspective of your work, of what that body of work looks like?
Yes, it gives me a sense of how I've changed and in what ways I've stayed the same. I did have the sense when I actually got the galleys and had to read through them for corrections, I thought, I really wanted to have an interesting life. And look at that. I have ended up with an interesting life. It's had its ups and downs. It's by no means perfect, but boy, has it been interesting. And it gave me a certain satisfaction to think all of these trips, which one by one felt significant in their own way, have added up to something that's bigger and that's more significant. That moved me a lot.
The name of the book is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, 7 Continents, 25 Years. The book is published by Scribner. Andrew Solomon, a great pleasure as always. Thank you very much for being with us.
A pleasure for me. Thank you so much.
Andrew Solomon will be reading from and talking about Far and Away at Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck, New York on Saturday, the 7th of May at 6 o'clock. You can find out more by going to oblongbooks.com. Oblongbooks.com. Again, the name of the book is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, 7 Continents, 25 Years. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.